You're listening to Dig Deep on Northern Community Radio. Instead of interviewing or giving questions to our gubernatorial candidates, we are here. I'm Heidi Holton, Aaron Brown, Chuck Marone, to talk about some of the questions that we had for those candidates. Maybe we'll be able to pose to them. I'm sure after they listen to this, they will want to come and get these kinds of questions. But Aaron, let's move into economy. You had a blog post that just kind of struck me, and you got a lot of response to this too, what the candidates focus on during as they run for office in our economies.
It was a thought I had on the primary election day, and one of the traditions on the Iron Range is your major candidates will stand with their campaign team and their signs outside the plant gate of a taconite mine. Typically, these have been DFL politicians over the years, but of course, you see Republican candidates doing it as well. Boise Cascade up in International Falls. The candidates meet the workers as they walk into work or drive into work in the case of the taconite plants. So I was looking at this and I had the thought, right now, candidates, they went there believing that those miners coming to work are going to see them there and be so dang excited to leave work at 3 and go out and vote for the candidate they saw. The reality is, like, I was looking at Hibbing Taconite. In Hibbing, the larger employer is the Fairview Medical Center. The hospital employs far more people than Hibbing Taconite. And if you include the entire medical campus, which includes several clinics and specialty service, medical service outfits that all work in the same area, in Hibbing along the Beltline, a huge multi-acre plot of medical services, there are probably twice as many workers going into the shift there. And my observation was, one of the reasons why they probably didn't go there is because a lot of those workers, because I've been on the hospital floors watching this happen, they double out, and if they haven't voted by the time they go to work, they probably won't get to. My point in bringing it up, and a lot of people took it different ways, my point was, why are we still catering to our idea of what our economy is as opposed to the reality of what our economy is and where workers actually are? We're becoming a service economy in the United States. It doesn't mean we don't mine. Doesn't mean we don't make things. But those industries have been automated to a large degree, and the workers who now work in those industries are advanced professionals. They operate amazing kinds of equipment. I always use the example of the students I've seen at the college who go to work in the mines, and one of the selling points in them getting the job is they know the code to make the machines work on a software level. In other words, they can program large machinery to do things because they know the code, like backslash this, that, the other thing, they can type that in and make these large machines and manipulate them to move whatever they got to do, load trains or whatever it is. That is remarkable, and those are important workers. They're obviously well paid. They're middle class or upper middle class on the Iron Range. But the workers making 30 grand, trying to raise a family, paycheck to paycheck, are in these service fields, whether it's medical or others. What are we doing for them? And what, whether it's a Republican or a Democrat, what can we do to appeal to those workers so they're excited to vote for a candidate? I wasn't going to ask it quite that way.
Right.
But that's what inspired me to ask, what are we going to do about the change in our rural economy where so many of our rural workers, greater Minnesota workers, are working in service industry fields? And what can we do to ease their burdens in this economy where they just work and don't get ahead?
You can see the candidates showing up at the motel when the shift workers come off.
Yeah.
To talk to the people who are in cleaning bathrooms.
The housekeepers as they leave at 4 o'clock,
We want you to go vote for us.
No,
they're not doing that. And it would be really hard to do it because there's, they're dispersed and there's not a concentration of them, and they get off at weird times and work weird hours and have multiple jobs. And, it is a very different economy. When I think about the way these candidates would have answered this, the right answer to this, the right of center answer for this, maybe I didn't mean the correct answer.
Here you go again.
the right of center, the Johnson answer for this, I think would have likely been along the lines of the Trump answer, which is, we want to make our economy more competitive. We want to, through tariffs and tax policy and what have you, put the American worker at the center instead of at the fringe. We don't want to benefit the multinational corporations and the others who are victimizing you. We want you to be paid for your labor and be more in charge of your destiny. And I think there's a certain compelling aspect to that. I think particularly that when you are looking for the man to not like, the multinational corporation makes it like a good boogeyman. I think that on the left, this idea of Medicare for all, which was the kind of Bernie Sanders crazy idea that's now gone relatively mainstream in the Democratic circles. It's no longer a fringe idea. You've got Joe Radinovich in our district. I just got a mailing from him yesterday, Medicare for all. I'm on board. I don't know what Walz's position on this is. But again, you're getting at this idea that as a worker trying to make ends meet, that as Aaron described it, what we want to do is take burdens off of your back. So you don't have to worry about switching jobs because you're going to lose your health care. You don't have to worry about getting sick and losing everything. These are two kind of ways to frame what essentially, and I don't think either of them solves the problem, gets at, what is the fragility of like the American family today and the American worker and this system we've created. If you go back to the days of the book that Aaron is writing now,
What's
the name of this again?
Well, the book is, it's about Victor Power, but we're working on a title.
Yeah,
now.
Untitled.
Right? I tell you untitled. What, I've thought about what is going to be in this book, and it's awesome. It's going to be fantastic. If you go back to those days.
Can I blurb you on that? No, sorry.
Yeah, no. What you have is you have like labor organized. And so it was, you know, capital and labor. And what we have done in years subsequent is we have centralized capital, like not only in these corporations, but also like outside of our communities. The biggest investors in Grand Rapids here are all multinational corporations that don't have anything to do. You couldn't even point to Grand Rapids on the map. They would point to Michigan, not Minnesota, right? And at the same time, we have like decentralized labor. We've spread it out. And I think the left response to that is, well, let's have government step in and, you know, do big things. And the right response to that has been, you know, the right of center response to that has been in the Trump age, let's push back on that. And through tariffs and policies and whatever, we're going to give you a fair fighting shot. And I don't think either of those gets at the underlying fundamental problems.
Yeah.
I don't know as Johnson or Walz would either, but.
Well, they wouldn't touch it. But the big question is, what do we do about automation? What do we do about the fact that when I went through Moose Lake the other day, the McDonald's in Moose Lake has an automated cashier system, and they're all going to get that. The McDonald's, the Hardee's, the whole lot of them. And yes, they'll still need human workers, and there are various realities to that. They can't go all automation, but there's going to be fewer workers. They're probably going to make a little bit more money because they'll need more technical people to know how to run everything. But what do we do with the people and the labor and the sense of purpose that work has always provided? In fact, that's in the fibers of our culture is this idea, and they've been pushing it for 500 years, this notion that a thrifty, hardworking population is a good population that makes America, or previous to that, Great Britain, you know, great.
Let me just add, too, I think in terms of like a rural Minnesota conversation, that's center to it.
I mean, there's nothing I think that unites your left wing and right wing rural people more than the idea of working hard.
A good work ethic.
You know, a work ethic. It's what we're known for. We take a lot of pride in it. And what do we do when we're mining, this is, I think, how we framed it in the question, we're mining this, we're getting the same amount of ore out of the ground to make steel as we did at the height of taconite back in the 1970s, but we're doing it with a fifth of the workforce or less. And we're doing the same thing in agriculture. We're producing food for our country and other countries. We're feeding, I don't know what percent, but a significant part of the world with our fertile fields and our amazing agricultural techniques taught by great institutions like the University of Minnesota. And we're doing this, and all of the people who used to work in the fields or run family farms are, what are they doing now? They're working for a lot less money and a lot less security, and they're frustrated and angry that they don't know where they fit in this economy.
And all the people who used to run, like, you know, I'm not part of the mine, I'm not part of this, but I run the local restaurant, or I have the local shoe store, or, you know, I have some, like, niche in this economy. And yeah, it's, I'm not getting rich, but I'm able to work at it and build up some equity and maybe get something I can sell to my kids or give to my kids at some point. That idea is gone too. I mean, I can go work, if I'm really lucky, for Target and put a little bit of money in my 401k and maybe get some company match at some point and have a tiny pittance, you know, at some point in the future. That is a really fragile situation for people. And I don't know, as either party, I mean, we've talked about this in the macro, that this is a hard problem to solve. I think for the candidates to get beyond platitudes on it, it is a really, really hard thing, because there's no kind of clear-cut, easy answer.
Going off of, you know, what different candidates might say, one of the things that has promise that you hear about is this notion of retraining. You know, I look at Scandinavia, and I'm interested in northern Sweden just because it's got so many parallels to northern Minnesota that fascinate me, the logging industry, the mining, and their towns are older, and you know, obviously they have a centralized government, and you know, whatever you think of that, the same effects are happening there as would happen here. And so because of that, I'm really fascinated. And one of the things I see...
Let me just put one clarification on that. They have a centralized government with a very, like, homogenous population. We have a centralized, many of our systems centralized, but we're trying to have centralized policy with Minnesotans and Texans and Californians and in, you know,
sure,
South Carolinians. And it's
they're
very
not as
different.
they're not as big as the United States, and they don't have as many different constituent groups.
Not only as big, but not as, like,
diverse. Yeah.
And I'm not saying that diversity is a bad thing. I'm just saying it's a lot easier. I've said this in the past. I think people have gotten mad at me for this. It's way easier to do collective action when everybody looks like you, and, like, you can relate to everybody around you. And that's not to say we should never do collective action, and that's not to say we should all look the same. It's just saying that you have a different burden. It's very easy for me to say, that family looks just like my family. I can see myself in them. When you cross cultures and you cross barriers and you cross ethnicities and you become this melting pot the way we are, it creates a whole different set of things you have to deal with just from a human standpoint to take collective mm-hmm. action. And Sweden doesn't have that, you know?
Yeah, though they're dealing with it because of their migrant population,
right.
and all of Europe is going through that challenge. I guess that wasn't the direction I was going, but it's a good point. I was thinking more like Minnesota has
right.
some parallels to Sweden in that way. And one of the things that you see is the attitude towards automation in the mines, for instance. That's one of the issues I wrote about once, is totally different. The miners there welcomed it because for the simple fact that it was safer to have a robot truck run by a person in a safe place as opposed to a truck that can roll down the side of a mine dump here in Minnesota. Not that that happens often, but in some cases when you're mining underground and things, there are some dangers. They mine underground more than we do. They embrace it, and it's all part of kind of a holistic system of, you know, we need to make this change, so we're going to train our existing workforce, our community that surrounds this company or this industry, and we're going to train them for the trends 20 years out so that these young workers are totally agile and adapt to this change. Here, we've done so little of that. We train them when we lay them off. We train them in these very narrow specifications. They have to do this or that to get their unemployment benefits. And if they do and do this and do that, then they you know, they come out with some kind of training. But it's training based on, you know, what's available at the college or what might be available right now as a job.
And we'll give you a student loan you can pay back over the next 25 years.
Yeah, and then coupled with that is we don't actually, we help, I mean, they get some help with the funding if you're laid off, if you're a dislocated worker. But if you're not a dislocated worker, you're just someone who has a really crappy job and you want to go back to college to train for a better job. And let's say you make a little bit of money, enough to have an apartment and, you know, maybe a car. which is not a lot of money, but it's enough money to make it so that you'll have to pay out of pocket to go to college. And what are we doing to get all of those people, the laid off workers whose industries have changed, the underemployed service workers, what are we doing to train them so that they have skills for whatever industry might come next or could be developed with entrepreneurship and new ideas and all these things that everybody seems to like? And that's the part that I see. And you get a little bit of that out of the answers of the candidates. I think both candidates, I was looking at their websites, Johnson and Walls, talk about retraining and they talk about community colleges and technical training. Republicans tend to like the idea of technical training because there's a dollar figure at the end of it. The worker gets a job and is therefore a productive citizen. And so there's some agreement on that. But I don't know that we really have the big picture in mind as a state yet. And I don't know that, you know, the idea of just throwing, whether it's just the Democratic idea of let's put money into higher education, and then the Republican idea of let's make sure the industries are strong so they're hiring our workers, it's just inadequate to our problem.
It is. And this is where I think the Trump phenomenon has filled the void in a sense. Because what we're talking about here is the implications in a sense of globalization, particularly on the most vulnerable workers. So, you know, if you are a college professor, if you are a reporter, if you are a radio producer, pretty hard to outsource those jobs to China. If you're a mill worker, if you are, you know, someone who, you know, works at McDonald's, we can buy a robot from China or we can ship your job to Taiwan or wherever it is. And we can do that well. It creates like a fragile group of people. We offset that in a sense by having things be cheaper. So your iPod is cheaper than it otherwise would be. Your television is cheaper.
There's a mountain of cheese puffs at Walmart that I can have for pennies, for a few bucks out of my pocket. I'm walking home with more cheese puffs than you'll ever need.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. So all those things, but those things are really benefits for you the higher up the financial scale you get. And at the very beginning, this kind of seemed like a good deal for everybody. And over time, it's kind of stratified more and more. So it's a good deal if you're in the upper middle class, good deal. Middle class, yeah, you know, it's getting there. Lower middle class, working poor, really, really a struggle. Because along with that, shifting the money away from buying your cheese doodles and what have you, you can now, you got to spend more on your house. You got to spend more on your car. You got to spend more on transportation. You got to spend more on all these other things that now are like obligations to exist in this country. I think the Trump phenomena has said, basically the Trump mantra, and you get this a little bit from the Johnson campaign, is that, you know, this system is not set up to help you, the worker. And by pushing back on globalization, essentially you're pushing back on, I think, the easiest thing to demonize of this. And, you know, in a way, you can say, yeah, this is the problem. The thing is, like, there's no real solution to that part of it. I mean, we're not going to stop trading. We're not going to, really change the way capital flows across international borders. We're really not going to do a whole bunch of stuff. And if we did, those cheese doodles that now make up, you know, 20% of your diet are going to cost five times more. And it's going to, you know, we're not going to manufacture those here locally for a long time. So I think that this lends itself well to demagoguery. It lends itself less well to policy. And that's because the policy part of it is just hard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And look at what's actually happening now that Trump's been in office with the Republican Congress. We've seen an erosion of environmental regulations, certainly a large tax cut. That was probably the signature accomplishment so far. And then the very conservative justices appointed to the Supreme Court and to federal courts. These are all things that I think Republicans like. But in terms of those workers who were so aggrieved, maybe even aggrieved enough to vote for Trump, who's not someone who resembles them per se, these things have all universally benefited the very people they were rallying, the upper class, the people who own the vast amount of property. And That's because that's the easiest thing for that side to do, you know, politically. Actually getting to helping these folks, and I think one of the reasons the Democratic Party has been so vulnerable on this, I'll say this coming from that side, is that they've lost their touch in talking to those folks, not just the quote-unquote white working class, because it's not just one race. If you're making, you know, less than 30 grand and you've got a kid or two or three and an apartment and an old car and you're trying to make it in this world, it's hard no matter who you are. And that group of people doesn't get attention on election day.
Let's do the extra. And yeah. I want to actually talk. I want to push back gently with Aaron on this notion that Trump does not have anything in common with the working poor. Because I think that he does in a very fundamental way that I think is interesting and often overlooked.
It's Chuck Marone, our conservative commentator. That's Aaron Brown.
Well, he's got my attention.
Yeah, I know. Liberal commentator, that was the tease. And you can get the extra podcast edition at our website, kexe.org. Can't see nothing brown.